I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're going to begin this hour talking about the continuing shockwaves rocking the mortgage markets and threatening the nation's overall economy. If you knew little or nothing about a pair of giant corporations called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you're not alone, but you're going to be hearing a lot more about them in the coming weeks. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the biggest providers of financing for domestic home loans. They own or guarantee roughly half of the nation's mortgages, providing the liquidity that allows the mortgage markets to function. So the fact that they are now in serious trouble is roiling the markets and making it difficult for stockholders and government regulators to sleep at night. Their stock fell so sharply this week that government officials have been discussing bailout plans to prevent a total collapse. It's the latest sign that the U.S. mortgage crisis is far from over. Joining us now from Washington is Matthew Bishop. He's the chief business writer and U.S. business editor for the Economist magazine. Matthew Bishop, welcome.
Hello.
Let's start with some background. I'm reading now that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae shares are continuing to drop and that in the last year they lost more than three-quarters of their value. What happened?
Well, I think they're very, very strange organizations, Fannie and Freddie. They are neither pure private companies nor an arm of the government. And so there's always been this sense of how do we value them that people haven't really been able to get their heads around. And what's happened in the last 18 months or so is that as the mortgage market crisis has got worse and spread into the financial system, people more and more are saying, well, does the government ultimately stand behind these two institutions? And increasingly they're saying, yes, the government will not let, it cannot afford to let Fannie and Freddie go out of business. And therefore, if push comes to shove, the government will take ownership of the debt of Fannie and Freddie. And in that scenario, the debt will be worth much more to investors than it is today, because when you've got the full face of the government standing behind that debt, it's better than that debt just being out there in the private market with a private company that could go bust standing behind it. And so investors are increasingly betting that the government is going to end up taking over these two institutions.
And what kind of bailout plans are being discussed by the U.S. government?
Well, I think they're actually flailing around, not really clear what to do, because they want to keep this strange arrangement in place where Fannie and Freddie remain technically private companies and therefore their shares still have some value. But in fact, investors don't really believe that that's a viable situation. And given the amounts of money that investors can make if the government does turn its implicit guarantee of Fannie and Freddie into an explicit formal guarantee of their debt, there's a real pressure on the share price to go down to zero so that the government has to come in and bail them out. So there are various plans around, but none of them really seem to me to address that sort of real psychological shift that's taken place in the market, which is that these companies can't really survive perhaps as private companies unless the government somehow buys all their debt or pumps in a huge amount of money that would seem a very odd thing to do just to keep the value of shares up.
Hmm. Matthew, remind us how important these corporations are to the mortgage markets. I mean, that is, if they were to fail and collapse without government intervention, it would be quite a thing, wouldn't it?
Well, they stand behind over $5 trillion of mortgage debt in the U.S. And although if they were to go bust, that wouldn't mean that everyone's mortgages immediately cease to have value or anything like that. It does mean that a lot of people who have lent mortgages would see their credit ratings dramatically worsen, and so you would have another round of credit crunch getting much worse in the markets and real worries spreading where even they aren't at the moment. So it's very important for the confidence of everybody that these two institutions continue to play their role. That, in fact, is so important. I think that's why no one really believes the government can let them fail in the sense of going out of business. So that guarantee that they provide, that $5.2 trillion of debt, that guarantee, I'm absolutely convinced, will remain intact. The question is, will those companies remain shareholder-owned companies, or will they end up somehow under the control of the government? And I think people are betting that they're going to end up you know, with the shares not worth very much, but the debt worth more than it's ever been worth because the government will be standing behind it.
Matthew Bishop is chief business writer for The Economist. He's based in New York. Matthew Bishop, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's safe to say that the summer's Olympic Games in Beijing will be known for much more than athletic competition. Behind the victories, the medals, and the defeats will be geopolitics. New athletic stars will undoubtedly emerge, but this year's Olympic narrative will also be the story of an ascendant China on the world stage. Global events and the defining political issues of the day often dominate the Olympics. They certainly did in Rome in 1960, when American sprinter Wilma Rudolph burst onto the scene.
It's Wilma Rudolph on the inside, closest to the pole, Giuseppina Leone. Look at Wilma move up as she comes around that turn. She's already taking the lead as she goes down the stretch.
Rudolph won 3 gold medals in Rome, but hers is just one of the many fascinating stories in the new book, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World, by David Marinus. And he joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. And David, welcome.
Thank you, Anthony. Great to be with you.
It's good to have you. And the idea behind the book seems to be is that by watching the Rome Olympics, you could see the modern world sort of emerging. There were big stories, right, about the Cold War, race, gender, even doping.
Absolutely right. That's what attracted me to this book. I love sports, but I also love sociology and culture and history. And I saw them all coming together in Rome in a fascinating way. The first doping scandal occurred during those Olympics when a Danish cyclist died in a road race. All of the testing that's followed over the decades began with that single event. The first televised Olympics, CBS got the contract in 1960. NBC will be sending 4,000 people to Beijing to cover the Olympics this year. That year it was a skeleton crew of fewer than 50. It was before satellite. They had to put the film and video on commercial jets to fly them back to New York to televise. Jim McKay was the host. He was in New York. He didn't even go to Rome.
So what would he do? He would get the tapes and then they'd sort of piece together a program after the fact, right?
He told me before he died that he would literally sit in the editing room while they were cutting and pasting that night's program, and he would tap out his script on a portable typewriter. If he didn't know about some nation that was winning a medal, he would turn to the Encyclopedia Britannica, not 100 researchers or the Google to help him. It was from that sort of archaic beginning that it all started.
Race and gender were big subjects in these games. You write about the American Wilma Rudolph, who won 3 gold medals. And up until then, nobody really followed women athletes in the Olympics. So this was a huge change as well.
It really was, partly because it was the first televised Olympics, partly because of Wilma Rudolph's grace and charisma, and partly because women were just starting to get a chance to show their stuff. It was a very important moment in women's athletics. You know, this was long before Title IX, long before there were many women's programs in track and field. It was considered unladylike for women to sweat. The longest race they were allowed to run was 880 meters. It wouldn't be for another 2 decades and more before they could run the marathon. But Wilma Rudolph and her Tiger Bells from little historically black Tennessee state won 6 gold medals and really paved the way for so many women to follow.
And there's more to say about her. She has quite a compelling story. Say a little bit more about who Wilma Rudolph was and her background.
She came from Clarksville, Tennessee, from a family of 22 children. She suffered childhood polio and scarlet fever, wore braces on her leg for several years, was pregnant at age 17, so she was a teenage mother. All of that before she got to Rome and before she won her 3 gold medals. And similarly, the Tiger Bells overcame so much. This school had no scholarships. The coach, Ed Temple, didn't even have his own office. He had to share an office with his wife, who was the postmaster. They didn't have means of transportation other than an old clunky station wagon. They'd drive through the Jim Crow South with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, afraid to stop for lunch or dinner. They couldn't even go to the bathroom in the service stations. They'd say it's time to hit the fields when they had to go. All of that, you know, really nothing. And out of that nothing came the most profound women's track and field program in history.
Wow. And, of course, in Rome, it was the first time that much of the world saw a young black boxer named Cassius Clay, who of course, becomes Muhammad Ali. He almost didn't go, I understood from reading your book, because he didn't want to get on the airplane.
Cassius Clay was afraid to fly. He said if God wanted us to fly, he'd give us wings.
You know, and apparently fly. He said that all the way to Rome, right?
Well, they gave him a sleeping pill to try to shut him up, but it didn't work. He kept yapping all the way to Rome, talking about how he was the greatest and he was going to win a gold medal and then become the champion of the world. Cassius Clay, at age 18, was the exact same personality that he would become later when he was the most famous athlete in the world as Muhammad Ali. But he didn't have any of the meaning behind it yet. At that point, he was still kind of the obstreperous little brother for his teammates on the Olympic team. He was a terrific boxer. He did win the gold medal in the light heavyweight division. After he won it, he wouldn't take the medal off. He wore it to bed that night and around the Olympic Village the next day boasting about it. Some of his teammates had to say, oh, Cassius, go sit down and shut up for a while. But that was Cassius Clay, the same character he would always be.
Tell the story about the American sprinter David Sim, who was recruited by the U.S. government to do what?
David Sim was a medical student at Duke University, a great sprinter. And right before he left for Rome, an intelligence agent asked him if he could come to Washington. They flew down to Washington. He went into a room. They pulled out a dossier and said, this is Igor Terovanesian, a Soviet long jumper. He's very westernized. He loves jazz. We know he's learning English. He came to Philadelphia last year on a track tour. We think he's ready to defect, and we would like you to help us close the deal.
Hmm.
Dave Sim agreed to do it. So he befriended Igor Terovanesian in Rome. They went out to dinner once. The plan was that at the second dinner, an American intelligence agent in Rome who went by the pseudonym Mr. Wolf, would come in and finish it off. So what happened, as both Sim and Terovanesian told me the story, is that at that second dinner, the Mr. Wolf showed up. He knew so much about Terovanesian that he knew that even though he grew up in the Ukraine, his parents were Armenian. And he started talking to Terovanesian in the Armenian dialect.
Wow.
It scared the heck out of him. He thought he was a double agent. So as they told the story, Terovanesian rose from his chair and pointed to Dave Sim and said, Dave Sim, I trust you, I don't. And he walked out, and the defection did not happen.
Wow. Why was the U.S. government so interested in getting Soviet athletes to defect? I mean, would this just be considered a public relations coup in the environment of the Cold War?
Propaganda was everything in that Cold War, and both sides were not only competing in the medal count, but in any other count they could get. This was a time of incredible tension in the Cold War. Right before the Olympics started, Gary Powers, the pilot of a spy plane, the reconnaissance U-2 plane that had been shot down over Soviet airspace, his trial had ended with a conviction on espionage charges. Before the Olympics ended, Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, set sail from the Baltic for the UN for the famous appearance where he would pound his fist and rail against the West. So it was in that incredibly tense moment that all of this was happening.
We're talking to David Marinus, the author of Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. We'll continue our conversation with him after the break. Later in the show, Barbara Ehrenreich takes a look at the nation's growing economic divide, and she doesn't like what she sees. Stay with us. It's Here and Now. And we're back with journalist David Marinus and his new book, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. And David, we were talking about the Cold War's shadow over the Games, and you describe how difficult it was for American athletes to lose to the Russians. And I'm thinking in particular of John Thomas, who was third in the high jump, and when he got home, he got hate mail. These Americans were under tremendous pressure.
Yes, and especially John Thomas. He was a 19-year-old high jumper from Boston University, the first man in the world ever to jump 7 feet indoors. He was regarded by the American press corps as the one sure gold medal lock of the Olympics. Well, he got to Rome and found out there were 3 Soviets who could jump over 7 feet, and he barely got the bronze medal. And sports writers, as they tend to do, treat any loss of that sort like the end of the world. So this was called Dark Thursday, the day that John Thomas lost. And when I talked to him 45-plus years after the event, he still said he never really recovered from that single loss.
Wow. And yet, for all the sort of unpleasant infection of the Olympics by this Cold War politics, you suggest that it might have had a beneficial effect on some of the big issues of the day, on race, for example.
Here was the United States presenting itself as the beacon of liberty around the world in a very important time of 1960 when civil rights was going on in the United States and 14 black African countries were getting their independence, fertile territory in the Cold War between the Soviets and the U.S. And the Soviets were pounding out the theme, well, how can you call yourselves the beacon of liberty when millions of your own people, including your best athletes, are treated as second-class citizens? And so that pressure was felt by the State Department, by the Eisenhower administration, and then by the Kennedy administration. And they acted more swiftly than they might have because of the obvious foreign policy hypocrisy of it.
Another story that I was struck by, Abibi Bakila, the first black African to win a gold medal for the marathon. He wins in the capital city of the country that had invaded his homeland 25 years earlier under Mussolini.
Nobody had heard of Abibi Bakila before that race. Half of the sports writers called him Bakila Abebe. They just didn't know about him. I interviewed the American marathoners, and Gordon McKenzie told me that as the race was about to begin on the Capitoline steps, he looked over and saw this skinny little guy, number 11, without any shoes on, and he turned to his teammate and said, well, that's one guy we won't have to worry about. But halfway through the race, Bakila's in the lead. They passed the Axum Obelisk, which Mussolini's army had stolen and dismantled from Axum, Ethiopia, and taken back to central Rome and put up. Here this barefoot Ethiopian is running by that. He takes off, shoots away, and wins the marathon by the fastest time ever, barefooted, ending at the Arch of Constantine in the evening darkness, floodlit by torchlights. It was a moment that is still renowned in all of Africa.
The Rome Olympics also marked the beginning of a change in how we view the term amateur athletes, right?
Yeah, it was one of those breaches in the whole notion of amateurism. In this case, a German athlete, Armin Hari, won the 100-meter dash, won the race wearing Adidas shoes for a certain amount of money, and then took the medal stand wearing Puma shoes for a certain amount of money. But you have to put it into the context of sort of the manipulation of athletes during that era. Amateurism was imposed on them, and they were treated with these draconian rules. For instance, Lee Calhoun, the great hurdler, was suspended for a full year because he and his wife got married on the television show Bride and Groom.
Oh, come on.
They said that was, you know, that he took some presents for that, and therefore he was no longer an amateur. It was that kind of ridiculous policy.
Yeah, there was another one that you referred to in the book, Rafer Johnson.
Rafer Johnson, the great decathlete.
So here's this athlete, and he had a chance to be in a movie because he befriended Kirk Douglas, right? And he was going to be in the movie, and the Olympic Committee said, no, you can't do that because you wouldn't be in the movie if you weren't
That's
a great
right,
athlete.
That's right, Anthony. Yeah. Rafer Johnson was an athlete from UCLA, really the best athlete of that era. Practiced on the UCLA track. Kirk Douglas lived nearby. Said, hey, I'm filming a movie called Spartacus. You could be in it. There's a role for a black slave. And Rafer Johnson wanted to be an actor. So he was very excited about it until the powers that be said, if you act in that movie, you cannot compete in Rome because you'll be trading on your status as an athlete to become a professional.
Wow. Let me ask a broad sort of question about this quaint notion of the Olympic ideal of sort of individual athletes competing against each other in this sort of pure spirit of competition and sportsmanship. It's a pipe dream, isn't it? I mean, we have this idea that that's the way it used to be. And sort of what I take away from your book is, no, politics have always been sort of there.
I think there are two tracks. I think there is a lot of wonderful athletic competition, but there's always the politics. It was there at the beginning. It was there in 1936 at the Berlin Olympics, staged by Hitler and the Nazis. It was there in 1968 with Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the Black Power Salute and the boycott against the South Africans. It was there in 1972 in the most tragic way with the murder of the Israeli athletes. It's always been there. In 1960, it was there for Africa, for Europe. East and West Germany competed as one team, even as they hated each other right before the Berlin Wall went up. Taiwan marched in with a banner saying under protest because they had to call themselves Taiwan and couldn't claim to be the Republic of China as they wanted to. It's one of the few places where the whole world is in the same place at the same time, so that unavoidably brings politics with it.
So what do you anticipate as we prepare to watch the Beijing Olympics this summer?
What I think is that these Olympics will be remembered as the Chinese Olympics. How they handled the pollution, how they handled the human rights issues will determine their introduction to this century. They view this as their introduction to their century, the 21st century, for better or worse, and that will be how it will be remembered.
And let me finally, David, ask you one more question. And for this, I have to ask you how old you are. Did you actually see the Rome Olympics? Do you recall them, or was this purely an academic sort of exercise for you?
I am 58 years old. I remember the end of the Pakistani-India field hockey game, and the Pakistanis winning in an upset and gathering in a huddle and cheering, "Wahoo, Wahoo, Pakistan." I'm an 11-year-old kid in Madison, Wisconsin, dancing around my living room yelling, "Wahoo, Wahoo, Pakistan." I don't know why. I just sort of liked the whole thing. And that's my most vivid memory.
That's great. Well, David Marinus, thanks so much for coming in. What a pleasure.
Okay, Anthony. Great talking to you.
It was great talking to you. That's Dave Marinus. He's the author of the new book, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Changed the World. And you're listening to Here and Now. Barbara Ehrenreich has been a longtime observer and critic of the class divide in America. In her book, Nickel and Dime, she wrote about her own effort to survive on the minimum wage. In her book, The Worst Years of Our Lives, she took on the Reagan administration. Now, in a new collection of essays, she looks at America today, and she doesn't like what she sees. Her new book is called This Land is Their Land, Notes from a Divided Nation, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
You cover a lot of ground in this book, but we want to talk to you about the topic that you touch on quite a bit, and that is this growing divide between rich and poor, a divide between the rich and the middle class. And you write that the U.S. economy is a zero-sum game and that it didn't always used to be that way. What do you mean by
no.
that?
No, well, the idea in the early 20th century, coming from industrial titans like Henry Ford, was that you had to pay your workers enough so that they could buy the stuff that they were making. And that was the sort of pact between labor and management until about the 1970s and 1980s that began to fall apart. And American employers began to look at their employees not as potential consumers, but as expenses that you want to eliminate.
What happened in that period of time in the 70s and the 80s? Was it just a sort of America became cold and ungenerous, or were there a series of sort of forces that helped sort of turn us away from that pact where it wasn't a zero-sum game?
As far as I can figure out, one was in the 70s, the recognition that there was foreign competition. You know, the auto industry suddenly had to compete with Japan. The other thing that happened is that the whole notion of the corporation changed from something that made a fine product and that, you know, that was a group of people who were dedicated to making that fine product, et cetera, and making profits along the way, to really being just sort of an agglomeration of assets that someone could control. And the more you could get short-term profits, the better for your shareholders. And since the CEO and top officers were increasingly shareholders by the 80s and 90s, it was in their interest, too, to just, you know, if you could eliminate 20% of your workforce, you would see profits go up briefly. Mm-hmm. So that became the incentive.
You have one piece in here in which you write about how difficult it is to be poor in the sense that it costs more to be poor. Can you talk about that?
Many things are more expensive for the poor. If you are trying to eat, for example, you may not be able to cook as well. You certainly won't be able to cook as well as, say, I could in my own kitchen, you know, where I have the pans and the pots and the spoons and the spices. If you don't have all that equipment, it's going to be a lot rougher. If you're even worse, just living in a residential motel, you might not even have a fridge or a microwave. So everything gets much more expensive, not to mention that the poor are charged more for things like auto insurance and, you know, this, it's what they call a ghetto tax on things like that.
What explains the fact, you think, that so many wealthy Americans are doing better than ever, but for most middle and working class Americans, wages have stagnated?
Well, one part of it is corporate policies that involve squeezing the mid-level and the lower employees to get as much money as possible going up to the top levels. But the other part of it is some of our biggest fortunes right now, I mean billions, are not being made even in ordinary corporations. They're hedge funds. It's all about finances. It's all about just money flowing from here to there. I can't even comprehend it. But it's not money that is made through actually making something visible or concrete. It's just financial flimflammery. And that's where you get guys now taking home $1 billion a year.
$1 billion a year.
Yeah. Uh-huh, and more.
You make it clear in this collection that this divide sort of permeates all kinds of areas in society. For instance, you have one essay, Pension or Penitentiary, and you write about a man named Timothy Bowers. Tell that story.
He lost his job, typical, you know, just downsizing, and went into a bank, demanded $80 of the teller. Then he stood by the door of the bank holding the $80 and waited for the police to come and arrest him. When he came to court, he told the judge, I am, you know, too young for Medicare and Social Security. I've also discovered I'm too old to get another job. I would like to go to jail for 3 years, please. And the judge said, okay. I guess that's the definition of compassionate conservatism.
It's a funny story, but it's also obviously, you know, it's poignant. It's telling, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's terrible.
You write as well about the shame that people who are unemployed feel, and you say they shouldn't. They need not feel the shame. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I think there it is deeply internalized into us that if we lose a job or something like that, that it's our fault. And there's a whole industry to internalize that into us, the whole motivational industry that says if you're positive and upbeat, all good things will happen to you. If you're not, then, well, that must be why you lost your job. You had a bad attitude or something. So we internalize these things. And I just think there's nothing more pernicious than to tell a person that they should be ashamed for something that they were the victim of.
This book, it's a series of essays that sort of points to many things that are wrong here in America and in many ways which many people are suffering, and it's true. But what has to happen to sort of turn it around?
Well, I think it helps to realize that some of these things, you know, happened quite recently, like the shifting of the tax burden from the rich to the middle class. That's pretty recent. The rich used to pay 90%. That was their tax rate. Now it's about 30%. This was done just, you know, since in the Reagan years. That could be reversed. We've been cutting back government services, public housing, all sorts of things. That could be reversed. Really, we have a job of rebuilding what has been smashed and devastated in, well, a lot of it in the last 8 years. Disgust with the situation is growing. I mean, we're growing out of that, I think, sort of lottery mentality of, oh, I could be rich too. Why should we, you know, criticize them? I'm just one lottery win away or from being in that status myself. And I think we're finally overcoming that.
You end your book, This Land is Their Land, with this sort of tongue-in-cheek essay called Postscript, Flee America. Is that a temptation? Is that you face? Is that all we can do? Flee?
No, it's not a temptation I personally face, because I'm one of those diehard Americans that the essay sort of makes fun of, who will stay and fight things out. Maybe it's because I just can't speak any other languages and I don't really have alternatives. But yeah, no, this is my country. They're not driving me out.
Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
That's Barbara Ehrenreich. Her book is This Land is Their Land, Notes from a Divided Nation. And still to come in the show, the heart of New York City is about to change in a way cyclists and pedestrians will love. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's Friday, it's summer, so we have to talk about baseball, and look who they let in the studio to do that. It's Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game.
It's not an obligation, Anthony. It'll be fun. Come on.
Good to see you again, Bill.
Good to be here.
So let's talk about this All-Star Game, the 79th annual All-Star Game coming Tuesday night, Yankee Stadium. And for Yankee Stadium, it's the last chance to play the game there because the old house that Ruth built is being torn down. How do we remember this great old stadium?
Well, we remember it, of course, as the house that Ruth built, as you said. And then in subsequent years, it became the house that various other people added luxury boxes to, which put it smack dab in the mainstream of sports in this country on the professional level. Yankee Stadium, I don't think, will be considered in the same way that people talk about Wrigley Field or Fenway Park, for example, you know, ancient ballparks preserved for reasons that transcend, practical considerations. But the original Yankee Stadium on its site where it is now was built a long time ago, and there'll be some people who'll say this is too bad. You know, I remember that old wedding cake facade and all the rest, and there'll be a certain amount of emotion involved.
The house that Ruth built, the house that the Steinbrenners are tearing down.
The house that Mr. Bluster blustered.
So let's talk about the All-Star lineups. The American League is basically Red Sox, Yankees in the infield, Kevin Youkilis, Dustin Pedroia, Derek Jeter at shortstop, Alex Rodriguez at third. The Red Sox, Manny Ramirez, is in the outfield with Josh Hamilton of Texas and Seattle's Ichiro Suzuki. Fair and balanced?
Well, it is interesting that the voters seem to fail to realize that neither the Yankees nor the Red Sox is in first place, isn't it? I mean, the first place team is not particularly well represented, as you have indicated. But if everybody agreed on who should be on the All-Star roster, all the bar rooms across this great land would implode for lack of hot air. So it's probably good that there's some dispute.
What about the National League roster? Does it look like maybe, just maybe, this year it could break the American League's recent domination of the All-Star?
When you look at the particular or the specific players, it's easy to say, hey, any number of these guys could be a hero on any given night, the given night that the All-Star game is held. Unhappily for the National League, it doesn't seem to work out that way very often, at least recently. The American League has dominated. I don't know what the reason is for that, but I would think the American League would have an extra added advantage this time around with a game in Yankee Stadium. Maybe the National Leaguers will be so awed by the place that they won't even be able to see any pitches till the fifth inning.
Okay, let's do a quick assessment of the baseball season at its midpoint. And I guess the big story, and you made reference to it a moment ago, is still that the once lowly Tampa Bay team, now called the Rays, they're no longer the Devil Rays.
That may be the explanation,
maybe
don't
that's
you think?
It. They're still the surprise leaders in the American League East. And I guess we have to stop saying, are they for real?
Well, they've had a tough week. They lost four games in a row for the first time this season. And they've had some injuries. They've had, the same kind of problems that tend to plague teams over the course of a long baseball season. But it is a wonderful story.
It really is.
In their entire existence, the Rays have finished better than last exactly once, and on that occasion, they were next to last. Here they are in first place at the All-Star break. I think it's a great story. Had a chance to visit with the Rays when they were most recently in Boston earlier this summer. And they are absolutely excited. They all talk about what a great clubhouse it is, what fun it is to come to work. They're having the time of their lives, and I hope it holds on. I hope they can manage to keep on doing what they're doing into the fall.
No disrespect to the American League West or Central, but let's jump over to the National League. All the divisions there are very tight, including mm-hmm. the West, where the Arizona Diamondbacks are in first place with a 500 record. Is that what the major league means by parity?
I think it's what it means if an entire division of teams that are mediocre or worse. This happened a couple of years ago. The team that won that division was 82-80. So, you know, we may be on the brink of that happening again.
Let's hear it for mediocrity. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program Only a Game, joins us regularly to talk about the week in sports. Thanks, Bill.
You're welcome, Anthony.
And coming up, we'll take a ride in a microcar, the alternative to macro gasoline prices, here and now. crude oil futures hit another high today, soaring above $147 a barrel. Because of record-high fuel prices, Americans, not surprisingly, are ditching those SUVs for more fuel-efficient, smaller cars. Which brings us to the microcar. It's tiny, as the name implies, but it can fit one or two adults and go pretty fast. It's similar in size and efficiency to those European smart cars that have landed in the U.S. this year. This weekend, dozens of vintage microcars will take to the roads outside of Boston as part of the 13th annual Microcar and Minicar Classic. The event's organizer is Charles Gould of Newton, Massachusetts, who has a large collection of microcars. Here in Now's Andrea Shea spent some time with him and found out these little cars are a lot more than just cute.
The microcars parked on Charles Gould's lawn look like their gas tanks could be filled with that shrinking potion from Alice in Wonderland.
They're like rabbits. You put one in your garage and they tend to multiply.
One of the cutest and most bizarre is a red British-made fiberglass number called the Bond Bug. Its one and only door lifts open like a hatch. Gould elaborates from the front seat.
We call it a cheese wedge or a doorstop because it's triangulated in shape and it has a single wheel in the front center and two wheels in the back. And it was very much designed as a cult car.
Gould, a lawyer, readily admits that he and his wife Nancy, who's an accountant, are card-carrying members of the microcar cult, along with their two young daughters.
Everybody asks us how many we have, and I typically tell them that my therapist won't allow me to discuss actual numbers, but we're seriously obsessed, and we've actually purchased quite a few. I think we're over 90 microcars at this point.
At this point, Gould asks this reporter the question she's been waiting for.
So you want to go for a ride?
Who could refuse? In his garage, Gould points to a low-riding, narrow car that looks more like an airplane cockpit than a land vehicle.
This is the 61 Messerschmitt Tiger.
It has a clear acrylic dome, and like a cockpit, it hinges from the top.
And when you close the dome, you'll feel that you're not claustrophobic at all, because you can see out the roof. Okay, you ready to start?
I'm ready.
Clear prop.
This Messerschmitt is for racing, but Gould says the story behind its earliest incarnation is the story behind the microcar genre in Europe after World War II.
The first Messerschmitts were designed by Fritz Fend, and they were designed originally as a car for people that were disabled or had become handicapped during the war. And they were a three-wheeled, hand-pedal-powered car that was supposed to help get them around. And what happened was it sold pretty well, so he put a small engine in it and made them powered three-wheeled cars for people that were disabled. And he noticed that the people that were buying them were actually able-bodied families and individuals and actually shopkeepers and owners.
Farmers, too. The cars were cheap, fast, and incredibly efficient with their two-stroke motor scooter engines. To keep up with demand, Fenn partnered with Messerschmitt Aircraft Works, one of the many factories that sat idle under the Reparations Act. Other manufacturers, such as BMW, followed suit. Eventually, bubble cars, as they soon came to be known, were riding the roads all over war-torn Europe. This archival sound is from a car show in London.
But from several countries comes evidence of the trend for smaller and smaller cars. Whether normal saloons or those increasingly popular newcomers, the bubble cars.
The bubble car fad burst after about 10 years, according to Charles Gould. His collection focuses on that period.
This here is a BMW Isetta, which is the consummate bubble car or microcar. If you talk to anybody about microcars, this is the image that comes to mind because it was just so bizarre.
Isetta is Italian for tiny little egg, and that's just what it looks like. The door is in the front, and you climb into it like some sort of a carnival ride. Gould's wife Nancy says their very first microcar was an Isetta. Before that, they collected normal-sized cars, such as Jaguars and Corvettes, but the little egg changed all that.
It was a blue one, and we took the first ride in it, and all of these spare parts came tumbling out of it. We trailed it home on a snowmobile trailer behind my Ford EXP, and everybody was looking at it on the way home.
And when we took it to car meets, we realized that people were leaving Bugattis to come and see it, and they were worried about you breathing on the paint, and we were buzzing kids around the field, giving them rides.
They remind you of something I often say that Dr. Seuss would draw. You expect to see the Lorax pop out of it, or, you know, the Grinch.
Ellen Hagney curates up to 30 summertime car shows at the Lars Anderson Auto Museum in Brookline. The Microcar Classic is one of the most popular after the Italian Car and Motorcycle Day in August. At that show and most expensive collectible car shows, Hagney says the rule is look but don't touch.
If you were to say to the Porsche Club, you know, let's have a Porsche petting zoo, they might say, no, absolutely not. You know, we can't do that. But with the microcars, it's expected and it's enjoyed.
Serious collectors laughed at Gould's microcars for years, which he says was great because many were given to him for free or for a few hundred dollars. Now they're worth much more, and the collecting world is catching on. Gould says he and his wife are planning to open a microcar museum here in Hudson.
So we refer to this as Matchbox Motors Microcar Museum.
About 45 cars are crammed into this warehouse space.
This is a 1961 Renault Dauphine.
The room is full of history and stories. My favorite is about the Peel Trident, one of the few cars to have been built on the Isle of Man off the coast of England.
Their slogan was, the Peel Trident, almost cheaper than walking.
Gould says the factory built 50 of this peculiar space-age-looking model.
And they sold so poorly that 35 of them were buried in a landfill in an insurance scam. And they told the insurance company that they were stolen. So there's really only 16 or 17 that ever hit the marketplace. So it's extremely rare. And nobody's ever found the ones that were buried.
Another rare find in Gould's collection is a micro caravan they tracked down in the Netherlands. It's the only one like it in the world. And this weekend, it will be on display at the Microcar Rally in Brookline.
That story brought to us by Here and Now's Andrea Shea. For more information on the Micro and Mini Car Classic this weekend, go to our website, here-now.org. As smaller cars buzz around the streets of suburban Boston this weekend, New Yorkers will soon enjoy a city with more bicycles. The plan is to close two car lanes on Broadway in Midtown Manhattan to make way for an esplanade that will include a bike lane, a pedestrian walkway, and space for cafe tables and flower pots. Barbara Randall is the executive director of the Fashion Center Business Improvement District, and she's been working on the new Broadway Boulevard, as it's called, and she joins us now from New York City. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So give us a picture of how this section of Broadway looks now and what it will look like in mid-August when it's scheduled to open.
Well, as you can imagine, it's solid traffic now. So we'll have, as you mentioned, a bike lane, and then there'll be a large, wide lane for pedestrians, and then there'll be two areas filled with cafe tables and chairs.
So is the plan, Barbara, to make this a permanent pedestrian and bike boulevard?
It is a permanent pedestrian bike boulevard.
And I guess some people are worried a little bit about how this will affect traffic in Midtown Manhattan. What do you say to such concern?
It's definitely going to be an adjustment, but we have to adjust our thinking about how we move people in densely populated urban areas. And this is a huge step forward in that endeavor.
Barbara, if, you know, to borrow and corrupt a famous line, if it can happen on Broadway in New York City, I guess it can happen anywhere, right?
It can happen anywhere.
Okay.
And, you know, we're hoping this is a model for other cities.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Barbara.
It was my pleasure.
That's Barbara Randall. She's executive director of the Fashion Center Business Improvement District. She's been working with New York City on plans for a new Broadway Boulevard.
They say the neon lights are bright all